This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest, part of two ABA New York Nets championship teams in 1974 and here in 1976 in the deciding Game 6 against the Denver Nuggets at Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum.
And now, the starting lineup for the New York Nets. At the guards, 6'3 from Princeton, the ABA leader in steals last year. This year's top three-point field goal shooter, number 14, is Brian Taylor.
Brian Taylor is one of the greatest basketball players to ever come out of New Jersey. Former NBA, ABA, Princeton University, and Perth Amboy High School star, he's been a longtime educator and motivator. Brian Taylor, the BT Express, joins us from Encino, California. Honored to have you on the show, Brian.
Well, it's a great honor to be able to talk to the great Doug Doyle as well. So thank you so much for the invitation, Doug.
Certainly my pleasure, Brian. Now, for those who, you know, there are a lot of people that remember Brian Taylor here in New Jersey, and also those who followed the New York Nets in the ABA, winning those world championships in 1974 and 76, and you had a brilliant career in the NBA as well. You were the ABA Rookie of the Year. You know, Brian, I had one of those ABA basketballs when I grew up, and I loved watching you and the ABA. It was a wonderful league, wasn't it?
Oh, it was so exciting to be a part of that league. I remember when I had an opportunity to go watch one of the playoff games with Rick Barry and the great South Carolina player, John Roach. I was so excited coming from Princeton. I was a junior at Princeton and going over to the island to watch them play in that red, white, and blue ball, and the excitement of the fans made it tough for me to make a decision whether I was going to leave college after my junior year. But the excitement of seeing all that made my decision a little bit easier.
That was a very controversial decision at the time, to leave early to go play as a professional. We're going to get into a lot of things, but let's go back to that since we're talking about it. That at that time, not a lot of people had made that move. Now it's you know, much more common, and we hear people leaving after 1 year of college. But for you, this, you took some heat about that, didn't you?
Oh, yes, I took a lot of heat about that. Leaving Princeton after my junior year and being one of the first players to do that. I think Julius Erving did it the year before. Spencer Haywood opened up the door for us with the great decision that the Supreme Court made, which forced the NBA to come up with a rule, and it was called the hardship rule, which meant that, you know, I grew up in a low-income family. We were poor. My dad worked very hard. My mom worked very hard. Very low-income family. And so I qualified as a hardship case. And I think if I was more of a middle-class person, I probably wouldn't have made the decision to leave Princeton after my junior year. But because of the economic opportunity at that point, I made that decision. It's really exciting to remember that it was such a big decision to make that Howard Cosell came down to Delaney Holmes, and that's the projects that I grew up in, to do a interview with my dad, Steve Taylor, and my mom, Maude Taylor, and, of course, myself. And Howard asked my dad, who worked in a factory, what kind of advice he was going to give me over this tough decision that I had to make. Was I going to stay at Prince University, or was I going to take the opportunity to go play pro ball? And so Howard, to be honest with you, I told my son he's got to take the money and run. So everybody laughed at that comment. And that's pretty much what I did. I took the money and I started running with the New York Nets.
Brian Taylor with 50 seconds left. Brian Taylor on the drive. Oh, what a play by Webster, but it's going to be goaltending. Nope, it's goaltending. Brian Taylor has 24, the Nets 5-4.
What a wonderful start with the Nets, and to be a part of two ABA championships and to play with one of the greatest players of all time, if not the greatest player of all time, at least one of the great showmen.
Dr. J up front, Williamson and Taylor in the backcourt for New York.
Joey Serving is who we're referring to. I know before we started the interview, two of your favorites were also guests here on Sports Jam, Earl the Pearl Monroe and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I loved Earl the Pearl Monroe. And, of course, I admire Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And just talking to you right now, I can't believe I was on the same court with both of them.
Yeah, you were on the same court with so many greats. You know, I played your videos for my sports class at Brookdale Community College just yesterday.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And a lot of them said, hey, wait, that was magic. Oh, that was Larry.
Right.
That was Larry Bird. And I said, yeah. And
that's,
you know,
right,
my favorite player that you played against was Artis Gilmore.
Oh, you know what? Artis is an amazing big man, the giant. Couldn't believe that we were able to beat that team in Kentucky with him and Dan Issel, and they had Louis, the great Louis Dampier, who's also in the Hall of Fame. And Artis, it's amazing about Artis' personality. Here he was, 7'2". And back then, Doug, we were wearing those little platform shoes, which gave us 2-3 inches. And could you imagine? He was like a giant, 7'5", and you're like really intimidated by him. And then when you went and you spoke to him, he had such a soft voice. You're like, why am I fearing this guy? This guy is, he's just got a beautiful heart, wonderful person. Also, he's on the board with me for the Drop and Dimes Foundation, which is a nonprofit foundation that gives back to our ADA veterans who are struggling with their medical issues and some financial struggles. So I know him very well. I'm looking forward to working with him to do some great things in the future.
And that's definitely why we wanted to have Brian Taylor here on Sports Jam. You have given back so much already in your life. Right now, as an educational consultant, you run basketball clinics for the Clippers. You have after-school programs that you're involved in. But let's talk about how these former ABA players, and many of them struggling health-wise, and some have passed, the good friends of yours through the years, and not getting the health insurance and the pension benefits that they so richly deserve. Unlike the NBA, when the merger happened many years ago, you thought maybe that the ABA players would get the same respect that the NBA players would get. And as you have been so eloquent through your years talking about, where would the NBA be without the ABA? Tell us what's so unjust right now, what's going on. Let our listeners know about what you and Artis are fighting for when it comes to former ABA players not getting what they deserve in health benefits.
Well, it's more than health benefits as well. It's also our pensions that were adjusted without our knowledge. So, Doug, what happened was me being a player rep for the Nets, also Doc was involved with American Basketball Association. We sat down. We were really excited about coming into the NBA. And one of the things we were excited about is that we were now going to be NBA players and that our pensions would be an NBA pension. And just recently, I'd say in the last 2 years, I was asked to be a part of a committee, a small committee of ABA players that were negotiating with the four teams that went into the NBA after the merger. And our issues were, one, guys didn't even know they had a pension. And two, the other guys were shortened by the monies that they received from the pension fund. Let me be a little bit more specific. Would you believe that our pension at that time, Doug, was $60 per month?
Who could live on that? Right?
Even back then. So it's interesting. People think that there was so much money in the game of basketball back in, you know, the early 70s and the middle 70s, and the salaries were very, very low. Of course, the ABA changed the economic system of the game because now you have two entities fighting for your service rather than one. But before, you know, the great players like Juice came into the ABA, Artis came into the ABA, George Gervin came into the ABA, the salaries were very, very low. The pension was $60. And then with the cost of living increase, when I came in 1972, it was up to $75 per month times the number of years you play. And then when the two leagues merged, it was up to 117, and we thought it was just going to continue escalating with the cost of living increase. And this recently, over the last couple of years, a lot of us realized that they had capped the cost of living increase 5 years later without our knowledge.
So how did that happen, Brian? How did that happen without knowledge? Was it written down in a contract and nobody looked at it? What happened?
Yeah, I think that what happened, it was just overlooked and it was assumed that we were going to be receiving the NBA-type pensions. And for the guys who had played 3 years or more who deserved to get their pensions, cost of living increases moving up, we're really, really upset about that. And then most of the guys were just not unaware, of that. So I was not involved with a suit, so several of the guys sued the NBA over these issues. And so I sat down with the four NBA teams with about four other guys, and we had three really big issues. One was that we wanted the guys who never received their pensions, of course, they received their pensions. Secondly, we wanted the guys who were shortened by their pensions to be able to receive the money that they were due. For instance, some guys were paid $75 per month, even though the rate was $117 per month. So after two really, really long sessions of negotiating with them in Los Angeles and New York, they agreed to make this up. One thing they wouldn't touch was the third bucket. We call them buckets. The bucket one was the guys who never received their pensions. Number two was the guys who were shortened of the pensions. Number three, the difference of the cost of living increases that we were not aware that they had cut them off 5 years after the merger. And so they said, you know what, we'll take care of bucket one, bucket two, but you got to deal with the NBA on bucket three. So we petitioned the NBA regarding this, and the NBA pretty much said, you know what, you know, we're not legally required to do that, so we're offering the guys a little help here, a little help there, and it really, really hasn't made a big difference with the guys. So we're just trying to figure out the best way to get the justice that the guys deserve, because it's so important. They're really struggling. And why is because they just, you know, just can't afford to live off of the small pensions that they have. Actually, they don't have the pensions. Guys who didn't play 3 years had no pensions. And then the guys who received the $117 or $75, there's just no way that they could have sustained that. And so there's a lot of medical issues, there's several financial challenges the guys are faced with. And for me, I was asked to pretty much nominated to lead this effort in this charge. Because they said, Brian, you went to Princeton. Isn't Princeton, didn't Princeton train you to be a leader? That's what their mission is. So I'm like, you're right. That's what I was trained to do. And the cause, it's a just cause. And I'm just trying to inspire people to do what's right. We're asking the NBA to give us what the pre-65 guys, you see. So just, there's a lot of history here. So what happened was the pre-65 guys were struggling at the time. They were receiving like $100 per month, and they were asking to receive $300 per month because the leagues had merged, and the BAA had merged into the NBA, and all of a sudden, the NBA was, the revenues had increased so much that they're like, well, we're struggling as well. And they negotiated for years and years. And finally, David Stern and the Players Association agreed to give the guys $300 a month times the number of years they play. And that's what we're asking for the ABA. We're not asking for them to pay us what the present guys are getting. We're just asking them to pay us the $300 per month that the pre-65 guys received, and pretty much they're saying that they're not legally required to do it. But we believe it's the morally correct thing to do. And we're pushing to make that happen. And so we're strategizing now to figure out how the best to accomplish this.
Back it goes to Tao. Head of the key back, ball stolen by Brian Taylor. Being trailed by Terry, Taylor dunks. Brian Taylor with his third steal in the ball game.
We're speaking with former ABA, NBA, Princeton University, and Perth Amboy High School basketball star Brian Taylor here on Sports Jam. Is it disappointing when you hear of these astronomical salaries that are being paid to NBA players that the greats of the past and those who just participated in the ABA can't get? You know, we hear about it in the NFL as well. It's like we forget whose shoulders we're standing on.
Yeah, it's sad. And it's sad to me because over the last year, we've lost about 10 guys, ABA guys. And one of them was very, very close to me, the great Tim Bassett. And this touched me because I was just doing clinics with him in my hometown of Perth Amboy this summer. And he was struggling with some cancer. And I remember the day he came to me and says, B, I beat it. I beat my cancer. It's in remission. And we were so excited. We hugged him. And the next thing I know, a month later, he had passed away. And he had struggled with his medical, the medical bills that he was faced with. And a lot of the guys, that passed away and really sad that the families, have nothing to look forward to financially, as well as, of course, losing someone they love so dearly makes it really, really sad for all the guys. So, I have hope. I believe that the cause is a just cause and that the purpose is to really help the ABA vets get what they deserve. And I have a lot of faith that it will happen. And, we're reaching out to as many people as possible to write letters and, talk to some of the present players, write to some of the present players. But more than anything, Doug, I've talked to the guys, and I'm like, we also have to be determined to do stuff for ourselves. And so one of the things that is on the table, and we even having difficulties with this one, is that we said, why don't you just allow us to have use of the ABA logos? And they refused to allow us to do that. We said, we're merchandise logos because people who want to buy different stuff, they love that old ABA stuff. We had an ABA convention, not convention, we had an ABA 50th reunion. We had over 100 guys come back in Indianapolis about a year ago, and there were tons of people in the big stadium waiting to sign autographs. There were like 3,000 people there.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. And it was great basketball.
Yeah, so what I am focused on is, all right, let's be self-determined. One way we can accomplish this is allow us to do some marketing of our old logos. NBA owns them. They won't even allow us to do that. As a matter of fact, on the 50th reunion, we wanted to use our ABA balls. And we had a tough time allowing us to use the logo for the old ABA ball. And the fans loved, like you said, you love that ABA ball. And the fans love that ABA ball. And so it just seems so unfair, and we just don't understand why we shouldn't be working together on this. And it's not a lot of money compared to what the guys are receiving today.
Do you have like a figure, Brian? We're speaking with Brian Taylor here on Sports Jam. Give me a figure that would be acceptable.
All right, let's visualize this, and I could send you some documents in terms of the calculations we've done. There's 150 guys that are eligible right now for their pensions. And if you break it down, there's only 9 guys that played. There's 6 guys that played the entire 9 years. So even if you calculate that, you're talking about nine times 300. Not talking about a lot of money. We're talking about $2,700 a month. You calculate that times 12, and then there's probably more 10 guys that played 7 or 8 years, and so the calculations are not enormous. They're such doable figures. So I don't really want to get into that too much. So there's some calculations I could send you that you may want to share sometime in the future. And it's just a touching situation. And one thing that is really difficult for me as I talk about this is that I don't really want to upset the NBA. There's been a lot of people who said, you know what you need to do? You need to go boycott. You need to have signs at the All-Star game. And you need to, when they have the finals, you need to be there with your signs and all of that. I don't believe that's the way to go. I believe the way to go is to appeal to the masses and have them believe that this is a just cause. It's an inspirational movement that I think will make this happen for the guys that need it so badly, Doug. I really believe that. And I think that the more people hear about this and the more people communicate with the NBA about this should be the morally correct thing to do, and the more we raise some money to help our own causes, I have faith that this is going to happen. But it's not going to happen without a great effort being made with all of us united. It's got to be unity of purpose for it to happen. Most recently, I did a call to action on Facebook, and the response has been unbelievable responses. Everybody is writing me back, Brian, what can we do? What can we do? And so we're still really strategizing as to what to tell, you know, our fans. And I think one thing that would probably really make an impact is if they, of course, send letters to the NBA. But we've talked to the NBA over the last 2 years. We've talked to the NBA. They pretty much said they're not really going to do anything. And so our appeal is if we can get the players to understand what the ABA guys have meant to the game of basketball, the NBAPA will have some input as to what may happen for us in the future. So if they split the cost, it's not an astronomical cost. You're talking about maybe $1 million from the Players Association, $1 million from the NBA, $2 million would take care of 115 guys. And it's going to be a model in which it's really unfortunate to say this, but the guys are like 66, 67, and they don't have much longer to live. Unfortunately, you're talking about probably a 10-year period, because if you do your research, we were doing the research the other day, and my lifespan could, you know, when you look at the figures and the data, they say African American male, most of them die at about 72. And so I can laugh about that. So I got to get this done now, because at 67, I got maybe 5 more years. Of course, I'm in pretty good condition. And if I stay healthy and wise and live properly, eat right, think right, do right, pray right, you know, I might live a lot longer than that. We really figure this is not going to be a commitment for a very, very long time, probably over the next 10 years. 115 guys will get down pretty much, you know, they'll pass away and there won't be that many guys. So when you look at it over to the long haul, it's really not much money in terms of what the assets both the NBAPA have and the NBA have.
Brian, is there a possibility that one of the legends of this game who has made so much money, somebody like a Michael Jordan or a Magic Johnson, could come through?
You just never know. You know, you really don't know. One of the challenges has been to make them aware of this, and this is why I've made the appeal. We've asked all the board members on the Drop and Dimes Foundation. Let me tell you a little bit about the Drop and Dimes Foundation. The Drop and Dimes Foundation was a foundation that was formed about 5 years ago with Mel Daniels, who was a great Hall of Famer from Indiana Pacers, leading the way because he had several guys that he played with that were passing away with nothing. He was making an appeal to all the guys that he knew, several guys that he played with that were living in New Orleans, homeless. You know, they were living under the bridges. And so about three or four gentlemen, businessmen from Indiana, decided to work with Mel and formed a nonprofit called Dropping Dimes. And they asked several guys to be a part of their board. You have quite a few guys on the board. We got Artis Gilmore. We got the great Hall of Famer, Rick Barry, Bob Costas, George McGinnis. Artis Gilmore, also Matt Calvin and the Dan Isso. And we're trying to give back to the guys that really needed badly, Doug. So it's kind of tough to talk about. You know, I'm really feeling a little sad just talking about it, but I'm also very, very faithful. And the folks that are listening, stay in touch with us. And I think we're going to make a difference. We're going to make a difference in the lives of other people that really need it for us.
And you may have touched upon something, too, through social media. The power of social media now when it comes to raising funds can be a big tool. Now, if people are out there listening and, you just as you mentioned, you never know who's out there listening. If somebody has the means to support that cause, what can they do right now? Where can they reach out?
Right now, I'm asking folks to make a contribution to the Dropping Dimes Foundation. It's a nonprofit foundation. You could go online as droppingdimes.org, and they're a nonprofit. 100% of the funds go to the former ABA players that need, believe it or not, it's, a lot of guys just need food. They need, they need shoes. They need that type of stuff. They need some help with the medicals. You got to remember also that there's no dental insurance. That's very costly. Everyone knows when you go to the dentist how costly it is. So that's a big challenge as well. There's no insurance for the families. Pretty much, though, on the insurance side, and this has been discussed, that on the insurance side, guys of my age, 65 or above, hey, they have Medicare. And if they're low income, they could get Medicaid. So the real challenge, though, is the pension dollars, the extra pension dollars that will go towards taking care of just the everyday living expenses that they don't have at this present time. And so Dropping Dimes right now is the way we're asking people to contribute. We're strategizing as to other ways to raise funds. I'm thinking strongly about a crowdfunding campaign. And one thing I want to show both the NBAPA and the NBA is that we do have a lot of fans, and a lot of fans want to contribute, but they're also expecting the NBA and the NBAPA to make some contributions to make this happen as well.
You know, as a lover of history, Brian, this subject touches me deeply because without the past, these great leagues that now make so much money, they just wouldn't happen. And, you know, people say, well, what do you mean? It was the merger. There were only four teams. Think of all the great players, and you have mentioned many of them as we've been doing this segment, that really made a difference in the NBA. So let's talk a little bit about your time in the ABA when you were winning championships with the Nets.
From the University of Massachusetts, 6'7", for three straight years, the ABA's most valuable player, the top scorer three of the last 4 years, including this year. What else can you say, ladies and gentlemen? Number 32, Julius Erving.
Tell us about Julius Erving as a teammate. What don't we know about the doctor?
Well, I think everyone knows how great a player he is, but I wonder if people really understand what kind of person he is. He's such a great diplomat, but he's got a great heart. I always tell people that the story about when I became Rookie of the Year, the next year, the Big talk was about the trade happening when Dr. J was coming home. And, Doug, I was worried as heck. I thought they were going to trade me to Virginia, because if we were going to get the Doc, they had to give up something that was shown that they could play. And I thought I was on my way to Virginia, but I was so excited when I heard that Doc was coming and I was still staying. And that first year we played together, boy, what a team we had. Super John Williamson and Mr. K, Larry Keenan, the Whopper. We were a sight to see. And the thing that I loved about Jesus is that, and I tell people, is that, you know, some of the stars, when their teammates make mistakes, they're really yelling at them and looking at them and with disdain. And Doc never once yelled at us. I mean, Doc always encouraged us. And that's the beauty of him. He was such an unselfish ball player. And I tell everybody, in the last year of the ABA, the reason I was able to shoot 42% as a three-point shooter was because I would give the ball up to Doc, and Doc would have two guys running out, and one of them would be mine, and he would always spot me up, and he loved to make that pass. He loved to make that pass for an assist, and his unselfishness really helped us win two championships, because everyone was focused on Dr. J. But Doc knew as well as I did, it took a team effort. We were deep. The first year we won it, not quite as deep. The second year we won it, but we had role players like Tim Bassett and Rich Jones and Tim Hughes that made our team a wonderful team over time.
People were hoping that the Knicks and the Nets, especially the Knicks, it's been a long time, would bring a championship. What did it mean for the city of New York, for the New York Nets of the ABA to win a championship? Tell us a little bit about the love affair with the fans at that time.
Of course, we had a lot of fans on Long Island, but the team still was the New York Knicks. They loved the Knicks, and it was so exciting when we played them during preseason, the times we played them. I think we beat them a couple of times, and I remember when they came out to play us at the Nassau Coliseum, it was kind of disturbing that they were cheering for the Knicks at our home court, and it was pretty upsetting. But our fans loved us. If you look at an old film of our championship game when we beat Denver in the last ABA game, the fans that came out onto the court, they went crazy.
10 seconds to the championship. Skinner has the ball. 5 seconds to the championship. Rich Jones, it's all over. It's all over with 3 seconds to go. And the crowd storms onto the court. 1 second, the clock is out, and the ball game's over. Pandemonium as the New York Nets win 112-106.
And this was really exciting, this to walk around Long Island, Hempstead, and we got great tributes. We got the key to the city, and it was just a wonderful time to be a champion in New York. And we had a lot of respect from the NBA. We were fortunate to have Dave DeBuscher as our general manager. Also, Bill Bradley was a big fan of ours, Princeton grad who I knew very well, and he recruited me to go to Princeton. And he also advised me that it was time to leave Princeton. People don't know this, Doug, but when I decided to leave Princeton after my junior year, I was being advised by Bill Bradley, because he was on the executive committee of the NBA Players Association, and he was telling me, Brian, there's going to be a merger very quickly, and if there's a merger, the economics will change in the game. Instead of having two entities vying for your services where the figures would go high, you'll only have one, and you have no leverage. And so with that knowledge, I decided to, like my dad said, you had to take the money and run. And Bill Bradley is somebody I'm going to reach out to. I think that he could be someone who could be an advocate for the cause of the ABA players. So there's several things I'm looking to do to make this happen for our ABA veterans.
Let's stay on the court with Princeton for a while and the legendary coach Pete Carril. At that time, you didn't look like everybody else on the Princeton Tigers, did you?
Uh-oh. And now you're talking about my first year at Princeton. I was the token. I was the only African-American player on the Princeton squad, but it didn't bother me so much until people started making a big deal of it. And so you got to remember the times. The times were the early 70s, civil rights movement, Vietnam. Princeton just made a surge at admitting more African-American students than ever. And they were really vocal about justice. And so just to see only one African-American player on Princeton University, when they wanted to, go to the buildings and protest, they were wondering where I stood on those issues. And my whole focus was, I'm a basketball player, and also I understand politics. I was a political science major. But how am I going to be able to fulfill both purposes? Coach Carrillo would be upset if I mispracticed to go protest and try to sit at a building or take a building over, which they were doing in the early 70s because of the Vietnam War as well as the civil rights movement. Or was I going to be on the court practices? Somehow, some way, I was able to manipulate both, but there was a lot of pressure on me to do one thing or the other, and I got through it. The next year, we had a young man from the Lake, Albertan, who came in from St. Louis, didn't play much, but he was a great teammate of mine. Also, Roger Gordon, who was a manager for us my first year, my sophomore year, he was a manager for the team. He also was able to get a uniform and be part of that squad. But I had wonderful teammates. To this day, I'm still friends with them. And it was tough pressure on me. But because I had great teammates and because I had a wonderful coach in Pete Carrillo, it was a wonderful experience for me to be a part of that 1971-72 squad that beat North Carolina, beat Michigan. We were number 13 in the country that year, Doug. We were an amazing team playing the Princeton offense, backdoor cutting. And I remember us when we beat North Carolina. I had been on the team with Bob McAdoo, a Pan-American team with Bob McAdoo, and he's in North Carolina. They came up to the players. They were number 2 in the country, and they had George Karl, Bobby Jones, and possibly that the great Bobby Jones would be in the Hall of Fame this year as an ABA player. And we were the Ivy League Princeton Tigers. And we ran them off the court. We backdoored them to death. And it was an amazing victory. And then just talking about it makes me excited. So despite the challenges of being an African-American student and player at Princeton, it was a wonderful experience for me. I love my teammates. Andy Rimmel was a big guy from Jersey. I don't know if you remember Andy Rimmel. John Berger is an amazing teammate. So I had some great teammates and then my friends to this day. So, I love Princeton. It was a tough experience for me on the earlier years when I was there. But, I'm a Tiger and I'm proud of it.
I had the opportunity to listen to some Princeton graduates had put together a special on you that I watched and heard the comments from your teammates talk about you as well as Coach Carrillo. The respect that people have for Brian Taylor, not only as a player, but more as a person, is one of the reasons I'm sure that, you have been selected to lead this charge to really get some justice for former ABA players. It makes all the sense in the world, Brian, the respect that you have gathered through your career. I guess when you look back at your career at Princeton, how many times do you really think about the fact that things could have went really sour that first year had you not been the type of person that you are and that your teammates didn't support you? It could have got ugly.
Well, I don't even look at it from that perspective. I just try to stay positive. And I, like I said, I had great friends. Coach Carrillo was somebody that was really a great mentor to me. I loved him then. I love him now. I love the friends I had in the city of Princeton. One thing that Princeton University did back then is that they aligned you up with a family in the town so that anytime you are struggling on campus, you had a family to go to have dinner with. And I was really lucky to have a great family. And I've spent a lot of time over their houses. I had great, great meals, and it was a great program for us. So I don't even look at it from the perspective that it could have been a negative experience, because I had so much support from my family. The reason I decided to go to Princeton is because there was tremendous support from the Perth Amboy fans and friends, and they kept coming to the game supporting us. So there was a lot of love that made it a great experience for me. And there were challenges. There were definitely some challenges, but because I had great support from home and from families and Princeton and my teammates and the coach, I got through it for the better.
Let's talk a little bit about the skills of the BT Express, Brian.
And it is the All-Stars again. They have scored 6 points in a row. Taylor finds Ron Boone, and the All-Stars lead by two.
You said, we ran them off the court. Boy, take a look at the highlights someday, folks. If you want to see somebody who could get down the court in a hurry, take a look at some of those All-Star games that Brian Taylor participated in. Let's go all the way back to Perth Amboy High School, where you are still ranked number 22 on the all-time scoring list. So can you imagine if you played in the game of today, even in the NBA, an up-tempo game where people were just flying, much like you did in the ABA? First of all, why were you so fast?
Why was I so fast? It was just a gift. It's a gift from up above, a gift from God. I worked hard on becoming fast. Every time we had drills, of course, basketball players know about the suicides. I was always first in the suicides because I worked hard and also was challenged to be faster by my very talented brother, Bruce Taylor, who was amazingly fast. You just watch some of his film on his punt returns when he's with the San Francisco 49ers. So the training I did with him made me even faster. And so it just takes a lot of hard work. A funny story, though, is that Coach Carrillo was always on my case because I was always I was so fast, I was outrunning the ball. And so the coach said, you know what? It's really interesting about my players. He said, I have players that come into the gym, and let's say Brian, he comes into the gym, all he does is work on his shooting. He doesn't need to work on his shooting. He needs to be working on his dribbling. So I have a guy like Armin Hill. He comes to the gym, and he's really doing all this fancy passing. He's a great playmaker, great passer, but he needs to be working on his shooting. So he told me, if you're going to make it in the NBA or the ABA at that time, you got to work on your dribbling. So I worked really hard. I learned how to keep the ball in front of me and not outrun the ball. And it was just so much fun that I went to the ABA where the game was up and down the court, three-point shooting. I got a trivia question I want to ask you, Doug. And so we'll put it in the perspective of today's game. The last ABA game, play Denver, high-scoring game. Actually, we were down by 25 points. We came back to win that by, I don't know, 8 or 9, something like that, close to that. And that's a high-scoring game. So the question I ask you is, how many three-pointers were shot in that game by how many people? What's your guess?
I'm going to say that only three people shot three-pointers that game, and you connected on the most of them.
Well, the truth of it is how many – only a few people shot. How many attempts, you think?
I'm going to say not as many as you might think.
Okay. Yeah, you're pretty smart because there's only 6 shots attempted, 3-point shots attempted in the game, and I saw them all. I think I was like 2 for 6. And you look at the game today. I went to the Clipper game the other day. I bet you the stats between both teams, there were probably 50 three-point attempts. I'm looking at the game now, and I'm like, oh, my God, if I was playing today, I wouldn't have to worry about coming down and looking over at the bench, wondering whether that's a good shot attempt. I remember I'd love to get down the court and shoot the pull-up jumper, using my speed to come up and pull up and shoot that little short jump shot. I remember when I went to the Nets in my first year as a rookie, Lou Carnesecca was the coach, and in one of the first games, I was doing just what I did at Princeton. I came down, and Lou looked up and he said, "Man, what are you doing? That's a bad shot." And I looked over and I said, "That's like a layup to me, coach. What are you talking about?"
Boy, you could make those three-pointers.
Way out there. They're talking about a four-point attempt. It's crazy.
You know, Steph Curry gets all the credit of being a great three-point shooter. You would rival him, wouldn't you?
I don't know about that. I was.
Come on now, Brian. Come on, be honest now.
I was not that great of a three-point shooter when I first started. I didn't think it was a good shot, though.
Three brings it down. 3 seconds. You see it on the screen. Three-pointer is good by Taylor.
I thought that if you missed a couple of them, it really affected your overall game. And so I, at first, really didn't like to shoot that game because I was taught by coach to take good shots. At that time, they looked at a three-point attempt as a bad shot. And so when I missed a couple, then it also made me concerned now that what I could make a 15 or 18-foot jumper. In my first year, I didn't shoot that many. I was probably four for 30. But I worked on it, and I worked on it, and then I was lucky that Kevin Lockery allowed us to shoot more in my third and fourth year. In my fourth year, I just became a marksman.
Let me give folks a little stat. You know, I know you don't want to boast, but when the NBA created the three-point line in 1980, you made 90 three-pointers. That was more than 19 of the 22 teams in the league.
Wow. That's amazing. And I shot about close to 40%, which is incredible as well. And so I sort of don't even like to talk too much about, you know, leading both the ABA and the NBA people in shooting because it takes away from what my grit was in the game. I was a great defensive player. And the reason I was is because, and I tell my kids who I train as young ball players, is that it just takes a lot of heart and a lot of effort and staying in front of people and being smart. I used to make note cards of the guy's strengths and weaknesses and study them. And so when I came into the game, I knew exactly how I wanted to play an individual player, also encourage guys with good coaching to play team defense. So I would rather be known as a great defender than this specialty player who was shooting three-pointers. I take a lot of pride in the fact that I had an all-around game. And then if you look at the game today, how many guys do you know that could lead the league in three-point shooting and was also on the all-defensive team? And so that's the type of pride I take in my game, is that I want to be known for a guy that knew how to play the game, played intelligently, and played both ends of the court.
Who taught you how to be a good defensive player?
I watched Clyde Frazier. I love Walt Frazier. That was my guy. And, of course, Coach Carrillo. Coach Carrillo was always on my case. He said, nobody should ever be able to bring the ball up against you. You know, he wanted me to play man-to-man defense, and we call it the 100. We called it the 100, which means you pick up the guy at the baseline. Anytime a guy got by me, which was rare, he would blow the whistle, and that's not acceptable to me. Nobody should be getting around you. And so, you know, I worked hard on just being a better defensive player in college, and I knew that going into the league, the way I was going to sustain myself was not being an offensive player, because you had so many great offensive players. Just think about who I played with. I was a really good shooter. You know, I shot probably close to 50% in my career, even with the three-point line sort of distracting from that, or taking away from that because the percentages were lower. But knowing that I can probably outshoot most of the guys on the team, my job was to distribute the ball. I had Dr. J on one side, Larry Keenan on the other side. You had the Whopper in the middle, and you had the great Super John, who always wanted the ball.
Yes, he did, didn't he?
So I got a little frustrated sometimes when, you know, I'm distributing the ball. I was like, what am I doing? I'm the best shooter out here, and I'm passing the ball up. But that was my job. I love playmaking, and it just made me a better player all around. And the reason I stayed in the ABA and the NBA so long is because I figured I could stay in there as long as I could if what I brought to the table was a defensive stopper. And so that's what my thinking was, that my longevity was based on my defense, not my offense.
Was there any player either in the ABA or NBA that you felt you couldn't guard as well as you'd like?
Of course. George Gervin was unbelievable, and David Thompson in the ABA. I mean, they're both – David was 6'4 and a half, but he jumped like he was 7 feet. George Gervin's 6'6, and he had so many moves. So my job there was the deny. Don't even let them get the ball. Once they got it, it was impossible to stop them. Going into the NBA, there were so many great guards. One of my all-time memories, great memories, was playing against the Knicks with Clyde and Earl in the backcourt. I got a great memory where I came in when I played from Kansas City. It was my first time back into New York after the merger, and I had gotten traded to Kansas City for Tiny Archibald, and it was a big day for me. And we had a great effort, and we tied the score was tied with, I don't know, 10 or 15 seconds left in the game, and the Knicks had the ball. And my job was to guard Clyde Frazier. Can you imagine my idol? I'm guarding my idol in this big game, my first year in the NBA. And I had my back to Earl taking the ball out of bounds, and I watched Clyde's eyes, and I knew the ball was coming. I jumped up and grabbed it, and it was me and Clyde going down the court. I was trying to get down the court so I could make this layup and win the game. And I'm driving on, and then, boom, the whistle blows. Clyde fouled me as I was going into the layup. I could see his face now protesting. That's not a foul. So I had a chance to go to the line and make a couple free throws, and we ran out of there with a victory when I was with the Kings. One of my, a game to remember.
Imagine, you know, just as you mentioned, your idol, and there you are. Did you ever think you would have the opportunity to go at him in a meaningful game?
Never. I mean, I was just, you know, I idolized him. He was just an amazing player. And then all of a sudden to be on the court with Clyde, and then also Earl, my dream. I have to tell you a little story about my dream about playing against Earl. My dream when I played against Earl was I wanted to block his shot. I wanted to be able to tell everybody that I blocked the Pearl's shot. But you knew how he played. So I remember he was just talking to you when you did an interview with him back in, I don't know, I think it was several years ago, 2013, how he was known as a one-on-one player. Well, he had me one-on-one, and he had me doing his little movement, you know, down in the paint. And this is my opportunity to get that block. So this is little Earl Monroe spin. He went up to shoot, and there I go flying to block that shot. And he just gives me that head fake. And then I'm coming down, and then he's going up. And then I blocked it right. Yeah, I got called on the foul. He went to the line laughing. He's not going to get a reputation on me, Mr. Taylor. So that's another great memory I had playing against Earl Monroe and Clyde Frazier.
Wonderful memories from Brian Taylor here on Sports Jam. He's joining us from Encino, California, where he lives now. You spent a couple of years coming back to New Jersey a while ago and even helping to run the Perth Amboy Boys and Girls Club. And your son, Bryce, is still playing basketball. He is a German citizen, still playing in Germany, and had a terrific career with the Oregon Ducks, too. Did you teach him defense?
No. I tried to teach him defense, but he loved to score. Bryce had a scoring mentality. And I used to tell him that the way you're going to stay in the game a long time is to play defense. And he's like, yeah, right, Dad. I said, also, you need to be a point guard because that's where you're going to have longevity in the game. At the time, he's like 6'3". Now he's about 6'4 and a half, 6'5". And he's like, I don't want to play point guard. I want to be the guy that's getting the ball. So he'd always be able to get – he was always getting the ball in high school at the wing and really, you know, taking it to the rack. Really could jump, and he's running and dunking. And I think he must have read what Earl Monroe, I remember a quote from Earl. He said, if you're expecting me to score a lot, you can't expect me to defend a lot either. And so that was Bryce's philosophy. But I think I inspired him later on, because he saw a video of mine when I was doing a clinic. And I think it's still somewhere in a video on the web, where I was doing a clinic and Gatorade was sponsoring it. And my specific job that clinic was to talk about defense. And I talked about the most important part of defense is your willingness to play defense, you know, to dig in there and play hard. And I remember him commenting to me about, you know what, Dad, I saw your video. I was surprised you didn't tell me you were doing clinics and Gatorade was sponsoring them. And I said, I don't really brag about that type of stuff. And then after that day, he wound up being a pretty good defensive player, and that's why he's been in the German League for about 11 years.
And you told me before we started, can speak fluent German.
He speaks fluent German. When I hear him in the interview speaking German, I'm like, that's my son. I'm so proud of him. Because can you imagine how hard that was for him to be able to speak German fluently? But he worked very hard at it. He used to tell us about the classes, how tough the classes he was taking, and that in order for him to become a German citizen, he had to pass this test. And we were very, very proud of him when he told us he passed the test, and even more proud of him. We're watching video, and we're wondering, what is he talking about? He's speaking German. It's really, really exciting to see that.
Does it give you just as much pleasure to see him have all this success on the basketball court than your own career?
Oh, definitely. Very, very much so. Of course, you know, to be honest with you, I felt he was good enough to play in the NBA, but we know how that is. It's a numbers game, and it's just, and this is what I tell young people. I tell them that you have to look at the opportunity as one that is very, very rare. There are some stats. You could go to NCAA, their site, and they break down the numbers, the percentages of it's less than 1% of guys who think they're going to make the pros in high school. By the time they get to college and the numbers continue to decrease, it's 1% of the high school athletes who wind up going to college, and then those who make it to the pros, maybe 1%. So I tell guys, you could dream, but you definitely have to have a backup plan, and that's why I was really into education. I felt that, and I feel this to today, and it could be cliche, some people say that you have to have something to fall back on, but I think the smartest thing I did in my career was to go back to Princeton after I tore my Achilles in my 10th year and I knew I couldn't play anymore. I went back to Princeton and completed my degree. I got a double degree. Really excited that I became a political science major, and also was at the beginning of African American studies, and now it's this whole department, and I was sort of a pioneer in that capacity as well. And that was the smartest thing I did, is to go back and get a degree from Princeton. Very, very proud of that.
And that was after a career with the New York Nets, the Kansas City Kings, the Denver Nuggets, the San Diego Clippers. How difficult was it to get that degree? Were studies difficult for you, or you were just so super motivated?
Well, I was motivated, but it was hard. And I had to do a thesis. I had to do a 100-page thesis. And this is after being in the league for 10 years, flying around the country and reading, but not those difficult books. It was very, very difficult. And I was married. I had my first child. I think she just several months old, and my wife decided to stay in San Diego while I was back at Princeton, which she understood was probably good for both of us, because she really didn't want to disrupt me too much as I was in the books. And also, she told everybody, well, I was used to Brian being gone, because as a professional player, he was gone half the time anyhow. So we were able to adjust to that, and they were very, very proud when they came back for graduation and saw me picking up my degree, cap and gown. And I'm also proud, I have to mention that I'm also very, very proud of my youngest son, Brendan Taylor, who has aspirations to be a professional basketball player. He's had a challenging road in terms of basketball, but a very, very talented basketball player. Very, very proud of him that he graduated in 3 years from University of Southern Cal. He went through on a basketball scholarship. And he got his double degree. He has his degree in psychology from USC after 3 years, and then he went on to study another year, attempting to get his master in psychology. So he's got 1 year into psychology, and he's got 1 year into business. He's a couple of courses short of having a PhD in business. So I'm very, very excited about his accomplishment in education.
Absolutely. And I know you lost your mom not long ago, and she definitely didn't want you to lose your Jersey roots, huh?
Yes, I'm very, very sad. Mom was recovering from an operation that we thought would give her a little bit more longevity. And she told me, you know what, don't forget home. She's very, very sad that my kids who grew up in California, and she didn't get a chance to get to know them as well as we all would have liked. And not to forget your roots, your brother here who misses you, you have a sister who's missing you. And at the time that I'm dealing with that, I get an opportunity from one of my former teammates who I was a freshman on the football team as a football player, and he asked me to fill in for a young lady who's on disability leave to come in and be a CEO of the Boys and Girls Club until she got back. Well, she never got back, and before you know it, I was the CEO for about 2 years, and I enjoyed spending time with, you know, my sister and my brother and all my family. But it was a tough transition, Doug. I was used to this warm weather out in California. I got sick, and about 6 months ago, I decided to come back in California. I kept my house in California. My kids are still out here. My wife was coming back and forth. And I decided to come back to California. And I'm feeling a lot better now. It was a tough time when I got ill back there. But since I've been in California, I've been under good doctor's care. And, of course, the love of my family has put me in a much better, healthy position.
We're so glad that you're doing better. Fred Fishkin, the terrific veteran broadcaster, put us in touch. You both went to the same high school in Perth Amboy.
Oh, yeah. Very, very proud members of the class of 69. Fred is a very good buddy of mine. And it's so special to be a Panther, Perth Amboy Panther. They were great times in high school. Fred told me a story the other day that really touched my heart. And we were talking about our mothers. And he said, you know what, Brian? I know how you felt about your mother, but I don't think I ever told you this, but I lost my mother when I was in high school. And you, because of the type of person you were and your achievements on the basketball court and what you did for the city of Perth Amboy, made me a happy young man. And that really touched my heart. And you just don't know how you've touched people. And so that's one of the things I always try to do, what my mom said. Doesn't take much to be a nice person. And she was more popular than any of her kids because she's just a lovely woman. And, you know, I miss her dearly. But she left me with one thing that helped sustain me through my struggles with my health issues. And on her deathbed, she told me, stay strong as a bull. I could just remember her telling me, stay strong as a bull. And I'm like, Mom, what are you telling me this? And as I was struggling a little bit with my health issues, the thing that kept me going was I had to stay strong as a bull.
Mm. And the BT Express has touched so many lives. Before we let you go, because you know that I could talk to you for days in this program, but we have to, somehow we knew that you would be a jazz fan, somebody who's so so much into education and someone who has performed so well at a high level. Of course you're a jazz fan. Tell us about your connection to jazz.
Well, it's really funny because my kids love all this hip-hop. You know, they're into hip-hop, and I'm like, hip-hop? You got to listen to some Marsalis and Herbie Hancock. Of course, they're the latest. Folks that have done so much in jazz. They never heard some of the younger, you know, some of the older guys in jazz. And I became a real jazz fan because my past father-in-law, the great Art Powell, was into jazz more than I was. And he left behind a collection of jazz videos. I want to send you some. You'll see the collection, and you're going to love it. You might even play some on your station. But I always loved jazz because it really got me up to play, just the music, and then it also helped me concentrate. Because when you're listening to the jazz, you're listening to all the different instruments, and you got to really be focusing on who's playing what, and different tones and different ups and downs, and it just really helped me focus on how I had to go out there and shoot that three-point shot and stop somebody defensively.
I remember that Grover Washington, did a tribute song to Dr. J.
That's right.
I can imagine that there should be a jazz artist right now that would be able to take a look at some of those Brian Taylor tapes and could put together a pretty, pretty good jazz tune.
Well, I tell everybody the reason I love basketball is because it just allows you to just be free. You know, the way I moved on the court is because I played so much jazz, I listened to so much jazz that I sort of played the game with speed, but I don't think you understand that I had to change that speed. And one of the guys that helped me change my speed is I used to work out with Bill Bradley. And one thing that Bill Bradley taught me is like, B, you have to change your gears. You're just all one speed. And you need to slow it down, then go, and maybe go fast and then slow it down. So he taught me some moves where I had to change movements, much like jazz. And I remember that. It was down at Lawrenceville. We used to work out down in Lawrenceville, the big field house, beautiful place. Unbelievable the way he approached the workout. He had his notes. After he complete a block here and a little block here, he'd go check it off. Very, very meticulous. And I learned a lot from him and on how to play the game. Also defensively, he taught me how to push a guy down to the baseline and use my hands. And he didn't have the kind of speed I had, but he had the knowledge of the game, and he was willing to share that with me, and I'm forever grateful for him doing that.
I would imagine that's why you were able to really pull up and hit those threes, because you had to be able to slow down and then get up in the air.
That's right. And then also I had a coach that, Pete Carrillo, that loved that, and he loved people misconstrued Princeton style, the Pete Carrillo style. When they think about Princeton, they think about Princeton who would hold the ball, and then make sure they take a good shot. But Coach loved that long-range shot. If we had the three-pointer when I was at Princeton, instead of averaging 25 points, I probably would have averaged 30-something points because he allowed me to shoot those shots coming down off the fast break and pulling up. And I did that in the NBA. I used to love to do that when I had the green light from Gene Shue, where I'd come down on a fast break and I'd pull up from the three-point line and, you know, knock them down. And that was really something that happened for me because I had a coach who believed in it in college.
So one last question here on Sports Jam with the great Brian Taylor. Brian, take your family out of this equation. You have just one more opportunity to go see your son play in Germany, your son Bryce play in Germany. And you're only allowed to take three people with you, but you can take anybody you want. There's no expense
no family, right?
No family members. Who are the three people?
Not even
people?
My brother?
Nobody. Nobody in the family. Who are you taking?
Wow. Wow, Doug. I got to take my man, Dr. J. Got to take that. I would love to take my Princeton buddy, Steve Mills, who's the president of the Knicks. He's a great basketball person that I would take. And the third person I would take would be, does a cousin count?
That's family.
You can't, that's family.
Can't do cousins.
Okay. That third one's a tough one. Let me think. Who's that third person? It has to be a female that I would take that loves basketball. And that would be, who's the female that I know loves basketball, would love to see Bryce play in Germany without family? It's a tough one. Doug, I can't think of the third person, but give me two more seconds to think who else I would take with me.
All right, then I'm going to make it easier for you. Now you're only allowed to select one family member.
Of course, I have to take my wife. She's his biggest fan, Terry Powell, Powell's daughter, who loves basketball. And let me tell you one last story about my wife and I, Terry, and my daughter, who's she's 24. Her name's Blaine. And just recently, maybe a year ago, my wife loves football and basketball. Of course, her father was a professional football player, and he loved basketball more than he loved football. And so she grew up in that family. And so we were watching football on a Sunday afternoon, and Terry and I are just there and really enjoying and relaxing. And my daughter comes and she says, you know what? Now I finally figured out what you two have in common. I never really knew what you two had in common. You guys seem so different. He says, Mom's love for sports and your love for sports is what your commonality. I get it now. I thought that was really funny. And so I would definitely have to take my wife because she knows the game real well. Her oldest son's in basketball. Her younger son's coaching basketball, still has a chance to play basketball. And her father was a great basketball player before he became a great professional football player. And she just loves, she loves sports. She loves basketball. I think basketball is her favorite, though. So I have to take Terry.
You kind of mentioned it earlier when you said I'd like more people to think about my defensive player. But when Brian Taylor is described by people, what would be the one sentence that you'd want people to use? Oh, I saw Brian Taylor play.
He made his teammates better. And it's unusual that he did that because he was a high scorer. He scored 85 points in one game, but he made his teammates better. How is that possible?
Was that called being in the zone, 85 points in one game?
That was called being unconscious.
You got to take us back to that game. What did it feel like, that game?
Oh, that game was, it's just spiritually, it was like, floating in the air. And we used to press. We had an outstanding press. And we were just pressing all over the place. And it's like every time I grabbed the ball and I had the freedom to shoot it and they started going in, I had no idea that I had that many points. As a matter of fact, on the record is that I only had 84 points because one of my late teammates who's Ronald Harris, who passed away several years ago, stepped over the line after I made my 85th point, and they took it away. And so on the records, I only scored 84 points, but I tell everybody, I really scored 85. I'm like, what is that referee doing? Why would he take a point away for, a guy stepping over the line and the game's almost over? And so it was just like I was on a high after the game, walking down the main street, main street in Perth Amboy, and really kind of embarrassed that I scored that many points. But definitely, that was definitely being unconscious. It's just, and I think I could remember my statistics that game. I think I was like 34 for 44. It's not that exactly close to that, and like 16 to 18 from the line. And so I was not missing, and they took me out of the game with a couple of minutes to go. We knew that it was a state record. like Coach B, Buglowski probably left me the game. But I was somewhat embarrassed by that because then I got the reputation that I was a gunner. And my brother even calls me a gunner to this day. And I'm like, I was more than a gunner. As a matter of fact, the way we played in Perth Amboy, everybody on the team was a gunner. I just got good at knowing how to tap their balls in. I knew how to get offensive rebounds.
Brian Taylor was good at a lot of things, as we have learned
here.
Thank
you so much, Doc.
You know, there's no doubt in my mind that you're the person to lead this charge to help former ABA players like yourself get what they richly deserve and get some health benefits and get the pension extended, and for some who never got it, to be able to live out their life with dignity after really helping form the NBA through their great efforts and great basketball and excitement that they brought to so many of us in the ABA. Brian Taylor,
wow,
continue. What's the way I feel?
That's so much. Don't forget to share this with some of your other media friends, because the more people that know about our struggle, the better it will be. And I really appreciate you too, Doug, because you're a Hall of Famer in my eyes.
I really appreciate that, Brian. So we will continue to get the word out about the cause. It's important. The BT Express has touched so many people, not only here in New Jersey, but around the world with his fabulous play. But as I mentioned during this show, it's really about the things that he has done off the court that he is so beloved by so many people. Brian, thanks for joining us on Sports Jam. And we really appreciate it, and continued success and good health to you and to your family as well.
Same to you, Doug. Appreciate you very much. Take care. Peace.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the shows by going to WBGO.org/SportsJam or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.